The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello, and welcome to MotoGP OD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Saturday, May 12th, 2007, and this is show number 77. I am Bob Hayes, your host, and I'm back. I'm back from Iraq. I'm done with my deployment. Longtime listeners to the show may know that I am in the Navy Reserve, and I was called up, and I had to go over to Iraq for several months, so I'm done. And new listeners, you may not know me, but I'm Bob. I started the show in 2005, did it for about a year or so, and then the Navy said that they needed me to go to Iraq. So I've been over there. I left the show in June of 2006, did some training in Gulfport, Mississippi, and went to Iraq in September and basically got home in April. Enough about the deployment. I'm not going to go into a lot of great details. I could post some photos or something on the internet if people are interested. One of the guys from the team put up some stuff at desertsailors.com if you want to take a look at that. But we're moving on now. We are going to talk about what this show is about, which is MotoGP and motorcycle road racing. I do want to say a big, big thank you to Jim Race and Jules Chisek for taking over the show while I was gone and putting up the episodes that they put up, and they did a great job. Putting up a podcast is a lot of work, and Jim and Jules did me a huge favor by taking it over and keeping things going while I was gone. So I do appreciate that, and I also appreciate all the emails and support that I received from listeners. I got a lot of email while I was over there in Iraq. I got letters and care packages even, so thank you very much to all of you out there that did that. I hope I responded to every email. I believe I did, but internet access over there sucked, so it was sometimes difficult, and if I did not reply to an email that you sent, I apologize greatly, and believe me, it was not intentional. And in fact, because the internet access was so crappy, I sort of lost touch. I mean, the whole preseason for this year, I just had no idea what was going on. It was all I could do to sort of check my email and things like that, and trying to keep up with websites and things, especially some of the busier websites that we get with MotoGP, like Crash.net and MotoGP.com for that matter. They were just impossible to load, or they were flat blocked. So I had a lot of difficulties with that, but whatever, trying to catch up, managed to watch all the races thus far this season. I had the couple that had actually occurred before I got home were recorded on my DVR. So seen all the races, and oh, what a season it's been so far. It's just been great. And Jules and I are going to talk about that here shortly. Like I said, we are going to get back onto a regular schedule. So we'll be doing shows every Friday. I'm not going to do those Monday race wrap-ups anymore. It was getting to be a little bit too much. The show was kind of turning into work, and I don't want that. It's a hobby. I want to enjoy it, and we're just going to keep it down to one show a week. So we'll talk about the previous show on, you know, the Friday. We can talk about the last weekend's race or whatever as it is. Next week, I have a track day on Thursday, which is really cool. That's on Thursday, May 17th up there in Portland. I'll be going up there and meeting Darren Carpenter, a longtime listener and my track day mentor, if you will, who's helped me out quite a bit. Did a couple track days up there last year and shared a pit with him, and I'm going to go back up there and do it again. But unfortunately, that means that this show coming up next week will probably be somewhat delayed, but we'll get it up there, and it'll be, you know, on the weekend, probably the same kind of thing where we get it up on Saturday or Sunday or something like that. Basically, right now, what we've got coming up is a conversation that Jules Chisek and I had about the China Grand Prix and about the season so far, and we just sort of talked about a lot of different things. Went a little bit longer than I initially had hoped. It's a little over an hour, but I don't think it got all rambly or anything, and we had a good time talking about it, and I hope you guys have a good time listening to it. So, why don't we stop with all this administrative stuff and get right into listening to that show. All right. Hi, Jules. How you doing?
Bob. Hi, Bob.
I am back.
It's a good to be back.
Thank you. It's great to be back. And it's good to be recording on the show again and getting a chance to talk with you about the season so far, which is starting to be a really good season. It's some interesting stuff.
And it's, I think that everybody's been taken by surprise. Everybody was expecting a season with Rossi and Pedrosa and some other guys fighting it out for scraps. And looking, we got Stoner, who was kind of came out of the blue at us. We saw him doing well in the preseason. The Ducati was obviously a good machine, but I don't think anybody expected this at all, including Rossi.
Yeah, I agree. And
Pedrosa.
Yeah, and yes, and all of anybody riding a Honda, really. It's shaping up, and I mean, it doesn't look like, you know, you wouldn't know that these guys, any of them, I mean, the field seems pretty tight as far as competitiveness. We're seeing teams that weren't all that competitive in previous years, Kawasaki and Suzuki, that are, you know, just getting right up there right away. So it doesn't seem like there's so much of a developmental stage like there was when we had the transition from two strokes to four strokes and things like that. It seems like a lot of people have gotten it right, with one noticeable huge exceptions possibly being Honda, although I think they're going to turn that around.
It was going around, and I guess you say Team KR has got some issues, but you know, they've always had the disadvantage of having to work somebody else's motor into a different frame. You know, the motor that was designed for the new Honda frame, they have to put in their own, so the chassis, I mean.
Right, yeah, I agree, and they'll... Again, also hopefully that they'll be able to turn this around and start getting some something going on, because they have, I mean, especially after last year, they were doing so well, and this year it's kind of sad, but I look for them to, you know, to turn that around somewhat and
kind of come up. They were really the last team, you know, like they were literally just taking their bikes out of the boxes when the rest of the teams were already going to the various preseason rounds, so. You know, they had a late start, and I'm guessing that by the time we get to Sachsenring, which is a race that Kenny did really well last year until his accident with Tanaka, I think they're going to be in good shape after that.
Okay, I certainly hope so. They because if that's true, they have been sort of deprived of a lot of valuable testing time. But overall, yes, I mean, the season has just gotten off to a whopping good start. And we wanted to talk a little bit today about China, to kind of have a race wrap up, since to sort of talk about that and the season in general. We seem to have gotten a good start. So do you want to move on to talking a little bit about China, or?
Yeah, let's go.
Okay. Why don't we start off with talking a little bit about qualifying and how that went. Front row of the grid, we had Valentino Rossi on pole. It was a fantastic lap that we're going to cover here in just a second. John Hopkins second. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that Rossi's pole was unusual, of course, because China is the one track that everybody just assumed was going to be a won by a horsepower bike, including Suzuki, which is not maybe as much horsepower as a Ducati, but they've been going much faster than the Yamahas on the straights. And basically, Yamaha has one of the slowest bikes in the paddock, so it was interesting to see him in the front.
Exactly. And you were saying earlier in an offline conversation that we were having that we're talking about, you know, Rossi was just having the perfect lap, and he managed to actually have two in a row, pretty much, that were, how far off were they in time? I mean, both.
Like, you know, 1/100th of a second or something like that.
Oh, wow. So. Yeah. And he was almost 9/10ths of a second ahead of Hopkins in second place on the grid. I mean, he was just head and shoulders above the field there. He really.
The most amazing was the fact that he was half a second faster than Pedrosa was last year on a, you know, bike with 20% more capacity. So that's just unbelievable. Because that was not done on the straight. That was done in last minute braking, perfect exits, you know, getting the right amount of drive out of every corner. And he was even saying, like, yeah, I was holding back to, you know, I was braking every corner. I was braking the last possible centimeter and expecting to go off. But just, you know, any time he was expecting to just run off the track, because he was just really, really pushing into the very, very edge. So it was cool. It was cool to see. You know, the master is still there, so.
Yeah, and he is. He's a, you know, he's a demon on the brakes, and when he puts it together, it's just, he's, you know, he's unbelievable. He becomes one with the motorcycle. And in second position on the grid, like I said, we had John Hopkins, who also, he put together a hell of a qualifying lap, and he did fantastically well. And then at the last minute, he was just outdone by Rossi. Although, like I said, he was almost 9/10ths back of Rossi, the gap from, you know, Hopkins on down is, you know, much closer. These guys were, or, you know, their lap times were quite consistently close to one another. It's just that Rossi broke away so far out of the rest of the pack. But Hopkins had managed, you know, he did an excellent lap, came in a second on the grid there, followed by Edwards. So we got the two Yamahas, the two factory Yamahas in the front row, split by the Suzuki, which, like I said, we've got Suzuki and Kawasaki to a certain extent, the perennial sort of somewhat underdog of the, you know, big four Japanese factories, doing much better this year. And that's really cool.
Yep. Definitely good to see. I was going to say one more thing Rossi's lap. I think that there was a couple times where his line was noticeably different than the other riders, and I think he found a trick to the China track that he didn't expect to find, because he himself was very surprised by the lap. He said when he saw the time he was going around, he didn't think that it was right.
Interesting.
He knew he was riding a good lap, but he didn't think it was going to be that much faster.
Right. Just didn't realize quite how much. I mean, you know, when you're talking that much of a gap, I mean, that's a huge gap. It's just insane. And, you know, it must have surprised him as much as it surprised everybody else. All right. So back on the second row of the grid in fourth spot, we had championship leader Casey Stoner. And he wasn't doing too bad. He was just a tad over a second, 1.092 off of Rossi's pace. Like I said, it was, you know, from Hopkins back to Stoner and everything, they were covered by just a not quite 0.2, actually like 0.1.
Yeah, it's important to know that he actually set that lap on his second Ducati, because the first one died. So, I think it's important to note that.
Yeah, I agree. It definitely is. I mean, although the bikes in theory, you know, you have the number one and the number two and they're identical and all that, in practice, that's never quite the case. I mean, they have one that the rider tends to like a little bit better.
Well, he was also making adjustments during the qualifying session too. Bike number one. I'm not sure if they actually copied the same settings to bike number to the entire time. They may do it after the session. I don't know how that works. Actually, that'd be a good question for Liam.
Exactly. Like, yeah, I think
do they take that, you know, have a twist here and have a twist there to both bikes?
Maybe they do. I think they try to do it if they have time, but you know how that works out. So, yeah. Second row, we got Stoner, then followed by Pedrosa, top of the Hondas there, in fifth position on the grid. And next to him in sixth position, Melandri on the Honda Gresini Honda. So we got our two top Honda riders there, Pedrosa and Melandri, and just a little bit farther back than Honda likes to be.
And we got a good mix of Michelin and Bridgestones. We got three of each.
Yes,
so exactly. You know, it's not unlike Turkey. Actually, as far as qualifying goes, Michelin's got the goods.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
No one's complaining about Michelin qualifying tires this year. That's for sure.
Right. Yeah, I agree. There seem to be some differences of them getting it right at on race day. You know, because Bridgestone has definitely made some strides, I think. But it's there's just so many factors. So third row back, run through the rest of qualifying. We had Depunier on a Kawasaki in seventh spot on the grid. Alex Barros on the Pramac Dantin Ducati in eighth spot. That'll make Liam happy. And then ninth spot, world champion Nicky Hayden, not getting off to the best of years at all. Just it seems to be one sort of bad luck and just can't come to grips with the bike. And, you know, one thing after another of problems for Hayden. And it's somewhat of a shame to see.
There was a good thread on Round 2 where David Emmett from Kropotkin Thinks posted a photo of, I believe it was Vermeulen, followed by Hayden coming out of a corner. And their body positions really speak volumes. Like, Vermeulen definitely is embracing the, you know, the corner speed approach, whereas Hayden is still trying his backing it in style. You could tell that just from his body position that he is trying to get that bike to do things that the 990s could do really well, but the 800s are not really designed to, except maybe for Tony Elias. But so he is definitely still struggling to, I think, understand how to ride this motorcycle faster. And also the Honda is frustrating, which is probably why. I bet you if the bike had better pace, he would probably not be trying so hard to do all the things that he knows usually does to make a bike go fast, you know?
Right. Understandable. So, he's having he and Cheka, who's, you know, not a big guy by any means, but both of them are struggling with the size of the motorcycle. Hayden can't even get a good tuck in behind the fairing. He's been waiting for a new fairing, I read, since Jerez, and it hasn't come through yet. I don't know if we're going to see it at Le Mans here next week or not, but it's difficult when in that position, where it seems like Honda is possibly, you know, for whatever reason, they've gone with a tiny little motorcycle. And of course, you know, the conspiracy theory, Honda bashing, whatever type of mindset is going to say that's because of Pedrosa And they somewhat have a history of doing that. They did it to Porto in the 250 series a few years ago, where Porto was complaining that he had helped develop the new 250 and this and that and the other. And then they basically turned around and made the bike too small for him.
That was also for Joseph's benefit, right?
At the time. You know, we'll have to see, because it is kind of a bummer to see Hayden struggling so badly. And we'll cover a little bit in the race, too, about some of the things that happened with Hayden. But on to the more of the qualifying. Back there in the fourth row of the grid in 10th spot, we had Nakano on the Konica Minolta Honda.
Another guy was struggling.
Yeah, yes, definitely struggling. And I don't know if is that a Konica Minolta thing to just always have to struggle? Or, you know, why are we having, you know, they didn't do all that well last year with Tamada, especially with his tire change. And now you got Nakano, who should be able to be doing a lot better. I mean, he was doing so well on the Kawasaki last year. I would think, you know, I sort of expect a little bit different out of him. But, you know, I mean, we're only four races into the season, so.
It's true, but you know what? I think that these riders, especially, they've both been on Bridgestones for so long, they just might really never really get a grip of the Michelins, unless the Michelins do something which, you know, with his front tire that turns things around this season.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is definitely that front end thing. It's like they both are complaining, and Honda is already having troubles with the front end. Even the guys who are used to the Michelins are complaining about the front end feel. So I can't even imagine what it's like if somebody was used to the Bridgestone, which has always had a very, very strong front tire. So,
Yeah, that's a good point. And yeah, if you don't, it's everything. The feel is everything. And if it's different than what you're expecting and different what you're used to, then you are going to have some problems. So.
Once you lose the confidence, you know, I mean, you just go to seconds.
Exactly. Yeah. So continuing on, we got 11th spot, Alex Hoffman on the second of the Pramac Dantin Ducatis. Another, you know, pretty good qualifying spot. They're doing real well, the satellite Ducati team. So that should make Liam happy. I know he said in your last show when you talked to him a little bit, you know, that we're here to win races. And he was talking about being almost disappointed with the fourth, you know, not outright disappointed, but, you know, somewhat like, you know, hey, I don't want to be celebrating. It's only fourth.
He was like, for 10 minutes, he's going about the enthusiasm in the paddock. I mean, those guys really deserve it. I mean,
yes, he did.
Really,
I know he's
going. Asses off. But yeah, you're right. I mean, that's the cool thing about them. It's like, okay, back to work, because what we really want to do is win. And they actually, you know, they've got the pace.
Yes, they do.
And they've got the riders. I mean, Alex Barros is great. He's a great rider.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, he is. And he's more than capable of bringing that bike onto the podium. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see them up there this year at all. They don't seem to have the and Liam said this again also, they definitely don't seem to have the sort of also ran motorcycle like you see other factories doing to their satellite teams. You know, this it seems to be roughly the equal of the factory bike. You know, they may not have every single brand newest bit, but you know, they certainly don't have a, you know, turd of a motorcycle. So you know, yep. I think that they're gonna do pretty well. 12th position on the grid, Jules's favorite rider, Tony Elias. Yeah. And we're gonna talk about Tony later too. Moving on down, 13th on the grid on the fifth row, Carlos Checa, followed by Loris Caparossi and Chris Vermeulen. We had in 14th and 15th spot on the grid. And initially, you know, you look at those numbers and you think, wow, what the hell happened? But there's a story behind that. And
well, basically, they went out in the hot lap, and it was a very strange moment. They, you know, I don't really know what was said between the two guys later. I'm sure they were both felt they were somewhat at fault. For me, it looked like that Vermeulen went in knowing that Caparossi was there. Caparossi did not know that Vermeulen was there. And, They just touched, but they were at such an angle that they both, one of them went down, and they, you know, it was just impossible for the other not to escape. So they both went down on their hot lap. They did not get a chance to do a better lap. So that's the reason why they were so far back, because they did have good pace.
Exactly.
In practice all weekend.
Yeah, and those times that they put in were from very early on in the session.
Yep.
Yeah, so. Yep. So, and then last row of the grid, 16th spot, we had Kenny Roberts Jr. on the Team KR. KR212V, and rounding out the grid, Sylvain Guintoli and Makoto Tamada on the Tech 3 Yamahas.
And the important thing to note there is, of course, they're running the Dunlops. And Dunlop qualifiers are even worse than their race tires. So,
Yeah, and since they get it so right in superbike racing, at least in AMA, you know, I mean, yep. and even in the 250s, you know, Dunlop rules those lower classes.
Exactly. And, well, I think that's where their effort lies. I don't think they've.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. We'll see. I mean, they did get that rule in their favor. They'd be crazy not to take advantage of it, you know, fully. So maybe we'll see something amazing.
And you mean the exception to the number of tires rule?
Yeah, exactly.
Because
they should be taking advantage of that.
Oh yeah, I agree. Hopefully they decide that they're going to spend the money, and however it's working between them and Tech 3 and all of that. But yeah, that they're going to come out there and do what they can.
Yep.
Because they need to do something. Because again, you know, you've got the satellite Yamaha team ostensibly on the same motorcycle as you know, the two guys that are on the front row, and you've got them filling out the back row of the grid. And if you're going to point to one single thing, it's going to be obviously tires. You know, it might be somewhat also that they don't have the same bike, because we know they don't, but it's still, that's a long ways down. So, and Olivier Jacques was unfortunately injured, and so did not grid.
There's some people are probably saying, yeah, phew, you know.
Yes, I believe they probably are, but there's other riders that they need to worry about that with. And Jacques's a good rider, so you know he'll hopefully we don't want to see
him. That's me. He's done that before, actually.
he'll be back soon.
He's just having a rough season because he's totally being outridden by his teammate. You know, he's getting up there in years, so he doesn't have too many years left, and. The expectations were very high because when he did come into the GP world as a substitute rider, he really kicked ass, you know.
And look at him in China last year.
Two years ago.
I lost a year there. I'm disappointed. Exactly.
That's right. You did lose a year.
But that was that surprised the crap out of everybody, that performance. Okay, well, we need to move on, and why don't we talk about the race a little bit, which was another, you know, this season so far has been so great. I mean, we started off there with the race in Qatar, which is, you know, hardly my favorite. I mean, the track itself, the layout of the track is fine. Yeah. It's just the dust and the lack of grip and the, you know, just.
Well, there's a lack of elevation changes.
Right.
I think elevation changes are really key to making a track really technical. Mm-hmm. But surprisingly, the races there have been pretty good every year. So, you know, it does elicit good races.
Yeah, it's one of the new, you know, and out of these first four races, three of them were at these newer Formula One Herman Tilke designed circuits. Mm-hmm. And of them, you know, Qatar and Shanghai are both somewhat soulless, I think. You know, I mean, they really don't ring my bells. I mean, and the runoff is so great. You can't even get the cameras close enough. So it's like, even when you're watching on TV, it's like the bikes are miles away. I do like the Turkey track though, Istanbul. I think that one's just great.
I think fans really like it. I think the riders like it, except, you know, Rossi, I guess, didn't like it, but. I know that if you talk to Kropotkin, he will just not stop talking about that track. He just loves the layout of that track. And I have to agree, it's got everything.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And I mean, they're actually considering taking it off the calendar next year.
Which is a shame.
Yeah, it's a damn shame.
Take China out.
Exactly. Take China or Qatar. But they're not going to take Qatar out because of the money that's coming in, which is certainly not coming in from ticket sales, but it's, you know. And that's what unfortunately makes it all go around. But, you know, China doesn't get much of a turnout for numbers of fans.
Actually, you know, if you really think about it, though, the best area to take a race out of would be Europe, as much as the fans are the biggest there. But, you know, if you really want to have a world sport, you really should represent every continent and stuff like that. I was really bummed that when the Velcom race got taken out, because I thought that first of all, it's a very interesting track, Pakisa. Mm-hmm. It's nice to know that a world sport is actually played all over the world instead of, like, you know, 90% in Europe and then a couple of flyaway races.
Yeah, I agree. And Brazil too, for that matter.
That's right. Brazil was a great trip, you know, and especially because, you know, it is a very popular sport over there. So
Oh yeah.
I'm not really sure what the deal is there.
Yeah, it's
because they had awesome turnouts over there.
Yeah, they do. I mean, well, you know, I mean, Brazil, they embrace their motorsport. You know, look at Formula One with Felipe Massa. And you got the same thing going on with you got Alex Barros and I mean they really do. But yeah, I agree on that. It's still very Eurocentric. Spain has three Grand Prix a year and now Italy's got a second one, you know, and I mean sure that they say, you know, it's the Grand Prix of San Marino or the Grand Prix of Catalunya and all of that, but you know,
it's Spain and Italy.
Exactly, you know. So in any event, China,
which nobody expected to be a good race at all. It was just like, it's going to be a snoozer. Everything's going to be spread out. Ducati's going to win. And, who knows everybody was saying there's going to be four Ducatis up in the top four and stuff like that. So I think it was a surprisingly good race. It was really one of the most enjoyable races,
I agree. It was, again, it's all of the four so far have been pretty good. If I had to point to one of the four that was, you know, the least exciting, if you want to use that term, it would be Jerez. I mean, it's not like exactly. I was, falling asleep in the chair or something, but it didn't strike me as quite the sort of race that I'm going to remember, and talk about next year or anything, as much, it's just, hey, good MotoGP race would be, the other three have all just been fantastic. And, and the 250s too, watching the 250s are, they're, putting in some just outstanding performances.
Outstanding's right.
Yeah. Right. So we did have an incident on, the first corner, the lights went out. We had Stoner getting the whole shot.
Hopper got the whole.
So
whole
shot. You're right. I knew, and I'm saying that it wasn't Stoner, but it wasn't. And I had my brain stuck on Elias for reasons that we're going to go into in half a second, and I screwed that up.
Yeah.
So okay, there's my token mistake, and that's it. I'm allowed to, but I am. I've been gone for a year. I'm a trained professional, right? All that. So in any case, yes, Hopper gets this whole shot, and it looks like he's actually he looked real good, solid there for a short distance and all. But we had a first corner incident that somewhat affected the race for quite a few people, big time, and that was when Tony Elias basically going back to reanalyze it. We have to say right that he came into that corner too hot.
Yeah, and you know what he said? I've heard it since the last time you and I talked. Uh-huh. I read somewhere that he said that he blames Hayden because he didn't expect Hayden to slow down.
Oh, and nice, and that's a good one. To be fair, I think Hayden did have to somewhat slow down for other incident on track, but I mean, Elias just came blasting in and basically nailed Hayden's rear wheel, which stood Hayden's bike up. And this is on turn one of, the first lap. And so Hayden goes trucking across the gravel and the grass. Elias crashes, slides across the track. Barros' bike hits Elias's and is somewhat jammed in. I mean, it was kind of looked like it was to me on the telecast. It looks like it was jammed between the front wheel and the radiator, basically. It's almost like Barros' bike was sort of, stuck there, like it was on a pit stand. It wouldn't fall over.
Right.
And and Barros, that the bike died. He had to start the bike. And this, you going out there and bump start such a high compression racing motorcycle, it's kind of amazing.
Well, first of all, just bother trying. Like the fact that he lost 40 seconds in that incident, including the bump start. So like, in Turkey, we had that first lap crash when Vermeulen ran over to the bike and picked it up. But the bike was still running. It was on top of Pedrosa's bike, and he actually got it off there by himself. By the time the corner works ran over, he was already on it and riding. He only lost 20 seconds. Like, to think that, okay, this is like a total fighting spirit. I love that kind of stuff when I see these guys do it. Some guys just walk away, but other guys just refuse. Another rider that we obviously haven't seen in a while is Biaggi. He also never just walked away from the following bike. Like Gibbonneau did that, and Pedrosa does that kind of stuff. Biaggi was always trying to pick up his bike and always trying to see if like, he could keep going. Bas has the same kind of flying spirit. He just like picked it up. But to have the bike stalled and then push started, and then get back on and still do a really amazing race is like, that's fantastic to see.
It's yeah, great. And it does show that, like you say, the guy's spirit. Because, by the time he got back in, now he's just dead last by a long, long way.
Yep.
And Hayden also, was last but one, and was behind the pack quite a bit. And after he didn't even he never dumped it or anything. He just took a little detour across the infield there, kind of cutting the corner. But it sucks off a lot of time. But meanwhile,
he lost about 8 seconds.
Sorry? Say again.
I think he lost about 8 seconds there.
Yeah.
So it's not that bad, but still, 8 seconds is a lot of time.
Right. Right. Especially right off the gate and having the year that Hayden's having so far. And he actually got a pretty good start, too. He was, it looked like he was,
sixth, I think.
Yeah.
Or seventh?
It was somewhere up in that kind of, it's a little hard to tell because there's that first corner jumble going on. You'd have to possibly freeze the frame and all that to kind of count. But yeah, he was definitely up in the front of the group. And so he got a real good start considering his qualifying, position was ninth. So. But in at the front, again, like I said, we had Hopkins looking like he was going to, be able to, he did get the whole shot, and it looked like he was going to be able to, lead some laps and everything, but it was not going to happen. It just was not to be, because
really hardcore breaking corner that they got to Rossi completely outbraked him and took over the lead, and by this time I think Edwards already has fallen behind Stoner, so it was Rossi and Hopper and Stoner passed Hopper, I think on the next corner.
Exactly, and
then they hit the final. What's that?
I was going to say it kind of established the pattern for the race. But at the end of the first lap, officially,
Rossi did actually lead the first lap officially.
Officially.
Within a couple of yards of passing the start and finish, the Ducati just powered past like everybody expected, and then it was the Yamaha nimble and braking versus Ducati and the power,
exactly. And watching the Rossi would come into that, and I think it's turn 11, 12, that complex right going onto the back straight there in Shanghai. And Rossi was just insane on the brakes. And I mean, you could just see, that he was pushing it to the limit. He's doing everything he can and managing, he's getting past Stoner there. And then the Ducati out on that straightaway would just walk away from the Yamaha. I mean, it wasn't like a sort of a gradual, showing him a wheel or anything. It was just like, and he's gone.
Yep.
And, it's like, wow, they just, Ducati has done something very, very right with this motorcycle there. We were talking about it earlier. They seem to have got the aerodynamics just spot on. They've admitted themselves that they've got the fuel management and electronics just, perfect. And to be able to turn the RPMs they're turning, because they're turning something over 19,000 RPM and running with smaller fuel tanks than they had last year. And all the other guys are not only baffled, but left in the dust when the Ducati can stretch its legs and like it can on these tracks with these long straightaways.
And people are saying that it's just a power bike. It's not. It's actually also very good to the corners. When there was only one small section that very quick left right where the Yamaha was really visibly quicker in corners. So it's not. Like, it's just a one-trick pony. It's definitely a good all-around machine. Right. And by the way, just a couple of days ago, I was reading a very interesting conversation on some mailing list that I'm on, and they were talking about the fact, I'm sure you heard about this, the Ducati got, Minoli came out and said he was really upset because the tech inspection, there was like extra tech inspection on the Ducati after the race, and there was some I don't know. Somebody was suggesting that there was that Ducati was doing something against the rules.
Oh, really?
And yeah, and oh, you haven't heard about this?
No, I haven't. I haven't heard.
Yeah, yeah, they were being investigated, quote unquote. It turned out that it was actually fairly standard procedure, but he did get a little bit miffed. He was he put out a press statement on the official Ducati blogs saying that, you know, it's, he just feels like you know, people should just accept that they just really did a lot of hard work from the heart. You know, like how Ducati is, they just, those guys really just go all out. And but then there was an interesting thread that I read, which was about the fact that the exact thing that the tech inspection was looking at was the temperature of the gasoline. And there's also interesting speculation about the fact that, you know, the tanks are smaller.
Right.
And gasoline has a coefficient of expansion that's like four times that of water. So it does actually, I'm sure you've heard many of these stories where, like, you fill a tank up in the evening and the next morning you wake up and, like, you know, there's gas spilling on the next to your car. So, the same thing is going to happen in these bikes, obviously. So I didn't see anything. I went and looked in the rules, and I don't see anything about there being anything against cooling the fuels, whether it's before the race or after the race. Mm-hmm. I know there's other disciplines, motorsports disciplines, where that is specifically not allowed. So that was a very interesting little thing. I wonder if they're doing something like, I don't know, some kind of, you know, cooling fins of the tank, something to keep the temperature of the fuel down so they can squeeze a little bit more in there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, possibly. Because I know that they, you know, there was a lot of talk about it, that's what they've done in the past, that fuel is not just cooled, but it's like chilled going in there. But I thought that there was something that they'd changed this year, but there's nothing in this year's rules that says anything about,
you know what, actually, I should change. I did not read these. I have a PDF that I saved last year, so these are not the update rules. Yeah, so
yeah, I think I do remember hearing somewhere, reading somewhere, and I can't remember the reference, so I might just be, you know, on crack. But I'm pretty sure that they might have changed something about that this year.
Okay.
And
knows more about this, like, let us know. That'd be very interesting stuff, and maybe
love to get some emails. So yeah, always. So in any case, back to the race, which was going on while we were having this cool discussion. They, like we said, you know, Rossi and Stoner had broken away. Hopkins was up there, so you got Rossi, Stoner, and Hopkins up front. Actually, it turned out to be Stoner, Rossi, Hopkins right in the second lap there. And you know that Stoner, and we mentioned this a little while ago, that Stoner and Rossi have led every single lap of every race so far this year. Those are the two guys that have led every lap. And the majority, the vast majority, something like 75% of them have been led by Stoner.
Yep. And compared to last year when we had four races and four different winners, it's like, you know, I mean, it was a very unusual season last year for sure, but it's good to, it's, I mean, I think it's interesting that you can have such a different season, and yet the racing, as long as the racing is still good, and it is.
Yeah.
It's not going to get boring, you know?
Right. I agree. And I mean, I was just thinking that about how am I going to formulate this comment that, you know, last year it was super exciting because on those first few races, it was like, it's so up for grabs, you know, it's very, very tight. Every, you know, you had all these different guys winning and this and that. And this year, you know, I mean, you know, we're only four races into it, but if you're going to call it anything with these four races so far, if you're going to call it something, you would call it somewhat of a runaway. Now, I don't think that this is necessarily how the whole season's going to shape out. But as of right now, you know, you've got Stoner with a commanding lead in the point standings. But each race has still been in and of itself this fantastic, you know, quality race. And this one in Japan, that those guys in front, you know, Rossi and Stoner in particular, and to a certain extent, Hopkins as well. And even at one point, Pedrosa, it was such good racing. I mean, that was all you saw. It was the classic thing of what you see on TV is the guys up front. And unfortunately, I think we missed some fantastic battles farther down the order because, you know, they simply, you know, the cameras were going to the guys in first and second place.
Right. In Turkey, we had the opposite because in Turkey, both Stoner and Elias got so far ahead of the field. There was 7 seconds between between Stoner and Elias in like 3 seconds to the next guy. So we actually did get to see that infield fighting.
Exactly.
And it was amazing fighting. You know, it was the best part of the race.
Exactly.
But this time around, I think we missed some good stuff. Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. But on the other hand, you know, we also saw some good stuff. So it's just, right. You know, it's one of those things where exactly, the multiple monitors and choosing what you want to watch, said, in the future when we're driving the air cars. And I actually saw on Speed Vision when I was, or Speed Channel, when I was watching something else, and they had a NASCAR commercial and they were going on about something. And I was going to ask, you know, has anybody actually done this yet? But on like the NASCAR website, you can do, you know, choose your angles and this and that and the other and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, that's what we need. And
yeah, because it's really useful in NASCAR. I want to see that left corner from
exactly.
Let's see. I want to see that. Yes. Wait, where am I seeing it from again?
Yeah, or the other the classic NASCAR thing. I want to see the gigantic 15 car pile up from, you know, every conceivable angle.
That's right. That's right. Here we go again. We just can't stop bashing NASCAR.
I can't. It's really hard. I mean.
It's so damn easy.
I digress. But basically, though, in a nutshell, what we had for the race, and we're starting to run a little long here, so I think we should kind of dash through it and cover the really high points of the race. But what we had was a fantastic battle between Rossi and Stoner with, you know, Rossi managing to get past him and Stoner passing him back and this and that. And then Rossi makes a mistake on what lap was it? Do you recall? It was fairly late.
I'm going to say 16th lap.
But. Yeah, like that. It was, you know, not quite the end of the race, but, you know, you've only got a few laps less. And Rossi runs real wide. And Hopkins.
He runs off the track.
Yes, exactly. And Hopkins manages to scooch in there. And so now you've all of a sudden got Hopkins in second position. And things started getting real exciting at that point. And I believe it was maybe what a lap and a half, that Rossi had that, and he had almost about a 2 second deficit behind
2 seconds. One big change.
One and change. Yeah. Yeah. Behind, Hopkins. And he managed to close that up in just shy of two laps and had gotten back past Hopkins, which must have been a little bit of an ego basher for Hopkins. And well, he probably didn't actually realize how the distance is involved and was in second. But unfortunately for, you know, for Rossi's point of view, there was no way he was going to be catching Stoner from that point on. He just did not have enough laps. And I don't think the race was ever in any doubt after that.
The commentary that from Stoner after the race was that he still had more left. He was not riding at the edge, whereas Rossi was obviously running at the edge. I wouldn't even call that a mistake. What Rossi said happened was that he basically had to try desperate measures, and he hit a tiny bump as he was braking, which you know cost him a few feet of braking. And that's the reason why he went off. And once he actually hit the rumble strip, he had to stand the bike up.
Right.
So that's why he went off. He went off. So he was saying that, you know, like it was just bad luck, and he had to try it. So he was really riding in a desperate way, whereas Stoner did not have to ride a desperate way. I'm not taking anything away from Stoner, because if we have a chance later, I'm going to sing all praise for the guy, because I think he is just fantastic. He's just super mature and unbreakable.
Yeah, I agree. Is he's 21 years old. You know, he's not a rookie by any stretch in MotoGP, but he's showing maturity beyond his years in any case. He's his racecraft. He's not allowing himself to be pressured into mistakes like Rossi. This, you know, the classic Rossi thing where Rossi has the supernatural control of the motorcycle and can pressure his opponents into, you know, crashing or running wide or what have you. And he just did it over and over and over again with Biaggi and Gibernau. The classic, whenever those were the challengers, you know, in previous years to Rossi, and Rossi could just make them screw it up every time. And he was trying to do that, I think, with Stoner this time. But like you said, Rossi was on the just almost on the ragged edge. You know, he was pushing it to the limit, and Stoner just had enough available, whether that's because of Stoner's riding skills or because of the superiority of the Ducati or just a combination of all the above, whatever. But Stoner had enough, and he also wasn't going to allow Rossi to get in his head. And he just rode an excellent race and won it, a well-deserved win, his third win out of four races this year.
Yeah. And, yeah. And no previous wins, so it's great to see.
Yeah.
There was a poll on MotoGP.com that let me see what it said exactly. It said, what has been the key to Stoner's early 2007 success? And the choices were like maturity, change to 800cc's, the GP7, Bridgestone. And overwhelmingly, people picked the Ducati Desmos Sedici. But I have to say that I really believe that and Marco Melandri said this during an interview on this Italian show that my friend Dario always translates for me. He said something like, if anybody thinks that Ducati will be what they are without Stoner, they're like totally, they have no idea what they're talking about. Stoner has made a tremendous difference for Ducati as well as they have made for him. So I think it's just a really good match.
Yeah.
Matchup for them.
I agree. It's the right guy on the right bike. But it's not all.
And the right tires.
And the right tires. Yes. But it's not all that the Ducati is head and shoulders above all the rest and just such a great motorcycle and all that, because if that were the case, where's Caparossi?
Exactly.
And I'm not knocking Caparossi.
If anybody thinks that Rossi is has lost it, you need to go back to the 2004 season where after four races he was also behind Gibernau by, I believe, like 16 points. Gibernau had won two races. Rossi was third in Le Mans. He was fourth in Le Mans with Carlos Checa finishing ahead of him his teammate, Carlos Checa, finishing in front of him on the Yamaha, on the same tires. So it's not like it's the first time that we've seen Rossi not leading a championship. It shouldn't be that big of a surprise. He is on an inferior bike.
Right. I totally agree. We've had it proven. There's always with the modern technology, it's just the bike and anybody can ride it and this and that. And that's a crock. We know that's just not true. It might be that there are better matchups. That who knows, maybe for whatever reason, this Ducati, and it seems to be true, that it's somewhat better suited for Stoner than it is for Caparossi, for whatever reason. Caparossi's having a little bit of bad luck. I mean, because he's an excellent rider. He's always done well.
Superb.
Yeah. But he's not getting off to the start that Stoner is. And
If you take Makota Tamada, for example, he came out of nowhere, got onto the right package, and won two races in 2004, and did and everybody was like, and the way he did it wasn't just like that he won, but the way he did it, he was like thumbing his nose at Valentino Rossi, at Biaggi. I mean, he was super cool character, and everybody was like, he's a super talented rider. Then he went to Michelin's and Konica, and I mean, he's done terrible since then.
Just fell through the floor.
He just fell through the floor completely. Yeah. So obviously, there is definitely something that matches up, and there's definitely bikes that no matter how good you are going to be on, you get on that bike, you're not going to win races. But
yeah.
I think when it comes to Ducati, Yamaha, Honda, and now this year Suzuki, I think that all those bikes are close enough. Maybe some of them have better, some a little better than others, but they're close enough that somebody who does have the resolve and maturity to ride a race without getting flustered, without making mistakes, they're going to win races, and that's what Stoner's doing.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good way to put it. I think you're right. Real quick on the what we finished with on the race. Like I said, Casey Stoner won the race. He did a superb job the entire race, the whole time long. It was a fantastic performance to watch. He ended up finishing 3 seconds ahead of Valentino Rossi in second spot, who was himself another three and a half seconds ahead of John Hopkins in third. Hopkins' first podium in what? This is his sixth year in MotoGP. So five full seasons, and it was so cool to see the guy actually get the podium. I mean, he's been in fifth, he's been in fourth, but he never has stood on the podium yet. And, on his history of two different teams, and it's so nice to see him up there. And because he's been faithful to Suzuki, he had the, opportunity to leave and chose to stay with Suzuki. And some people were like, what are you, crazy? But, I think he may have made the right decision, because it sounds like they're letting him develop the bike.
Yep.
You know, he picked up a third, so it's, hey, that's really cool for him.
Congratulations, Hopper. We were all shouting very happily in my household when he got that third.
Yeah. Yes. There's lots of
closet Hopper fans.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, I'm a Hopper fan. I like the guy. He's got, he's American, and he's got this sort of Anglo thing going on as well. And so, I think Hopkins is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Pedrosa came in fourth, a fairly, lonely fourth. He was 14 seconds back from Stoner, which, he was basically riding fourth by himself there. For a while there, he had managed to pass Hopkins and looked like he was going to be in third. And there was a little bit of a battle going on but it was pretty brief. And then eventually, Hopkins had left him in behind and Pedrosa ran, a steady, good race that he finished fourth in, 14 seconds behind
that pretty much sums up his season. He's really not done much actual racing. He's just been riding, and him and Hopper have come together a few times, and Daniel got the best of Hopper once, so
right. And I agree. In the right now in the point standings for the championship overall, he's third.
Yep.
But
was he 37 points behind Stoner? It's a lot of ground.
Yeah.
But he's the fastest. Exactly. He's the best Honda, so that's something to consider too.
Right. Right.
He's always the best Honda. Well, yeah. No, that's essentially Elias got him in Turkey.
Yeah. The interesting thing is, I thought it was kind of interesting. Right now, 1-2-3 in the world, in the championship standings, world championship standings, is Stoner, Rossi, Pedrosa, 1-2-3. And that's how they finished in Qatar. 1-2-3. Yeah. Which, mildly interesting, so I'll admit. And also, another interesting thing, you got, like you said, Pedrosa it's almost 40 points. He's, 37 points behind the leaders in championship standings, 86 points that Stoner has in four races. Pedrosa's on 49. But things tighten up at that point, and you've got back down, down to, 10th. There's only 19 points, which is a more sort of, when you're at the fourth race of the season, is a more sort of a normal distance. But there's three guys on 30 and, 31, 35 points. So once you get past the, number one and two, it's a very tight championship, but for third place. But beyond that, it's so far, it's somewhat looking like a runaway. And like I said earlier here in our call, I don't think that's going to be what we see the entire season long. But it sure is his first four races. And actually, out of the next three, I think you're going to see Ducati doing well at two of those for sure. Catalunya and Mugello both have long straights that the Ducati is going to be able to stretch their legs. And Mugello is basically their home track. So if they don't do well there, they will.
They will. They always do well there.
Yeah. Safe money is that Le Mans is probably going to be a Yamaha track, more so than a Ducati track, but we'll have to see.
I think it's actually really interesting. I think that Stoner did not have a good ride in Jerez, and I think that what we'll see, what will be very interesting to see is how he'll do in Le Mans, because that might set that might change our expectations of what to see the rest of the season. Because if they can do really well, if they can win the races on the really, really fast tracks, there's plenty of those left, but if they can also keep up, if you can keep up and get score podiums on the tracks where they're not supposed to be quite as good, then I think that that's going to be the proof that it's Ducati's year,
Yeah, and that's possibility.
Stoner's year.
What did Stoner came in what fifth in Jerez, which. You win three and you come in fifth on one. That's pretty good. That's world championship win.
Better than me.
Say again.
Better than me.
Yes, but you know, because I mean, you know, you got two ways to win a championship. You can be super consistent, always coming in second, and uh-huh. and you've got a real good chance of winning that championship. Or you can, you know, win a crap load and then kind of tank the other ones, and you know, and you'll still have more points. So
it's just interesting. Last year's championship was won by somebody who won two races, and Stone has already won three.
Yeah, exactly. That's a real good point. And unfortunately, we really lost a lot of quality there. And what hopefully we can fix it. But what Jules just said was that last season the championship was won by somebody who only won two races. And so far this season, Stoner's already won three races himself. And that brings up a point. And I'm a big Nicky Hayden fan. There's no doubt about it. But he last year, and I don't want to say like that he fell into the championship or anything like that, but let's face facts. He rode steady, reliable, consistent, but never stellar. You know, he was never the super, you know, wow, hoorah, rider there. He was just, very, very good and consistent, and then managed to come in a year where Rossi had a lot of bad luck that pretty much put him out of contention. And so, you know, Hayden managed to get the championship. And I'm not saying he didn't deserve it. I'm not saying he didn't earn it or any of that kind of stuff. You know, he did, but he just sort of won it a different way than well, for instance, Rossi tends to win his championships, where it's more of a resounding victory. There is no doubt. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, exactly. That thing. You know, but I have to say that, it's kind of the championship last year has really grown on me. I am a Nicky Hayden fan, because he's a good guy.
Yes.
But I've always felt very strange about that season. But I do think that the victory has grown on me. I think that consistency should be rewarded. All that hard work should be rewarded. It's like, it's not just about being born a certain way. You can become a champion by being just a freaking hardworking dude, and he's one of the hardest working dude in the paddocks, you know. So
good
job, Nicky.
Yes, I agree. And you're breaking up real bad, Jules. Okay, we're back. We had a small technical difficulty, as you can tell, because I left some of that stuff in with Jules, because I thought it was that what he was his comments were good, and I don't want him to have to try to remember what he said and say it all over again. But if you couldn't understand it, because it was a little bit like this, is that Jules was saying
that's what happens if Bob had a few beers.
Yes, I've had a few beers. Last season was a pretty interesting season with Hayden winning. We're way running longer than we said we were going to talk, Jules. This is a shocker. So why don't we zip down the order real quick, and then I know you have some comments that you're dying to make about your last show and that you did and stuff that we had talked about earlier. So, fourth place, like I said, we had Pedrosa. Fifth place, Melandri, doing real well, coming in fifth place fairly consistently.
He's been fifth, seventh, fifth. No, he's been fifth, eighth, fifth, and fifth.
Yes, exactly. So and you know, that's the way to come in fifth in the championship.
But he's fourth. Come on.
Yes, he's fourth now. Give it time. Caparossi, sixth place, followed by Vermeulen, sixth and seventh. They finished up only a say again?
They were like the 200s apart, I think, right?
Yeah, they were. I mean, like I said, that would have been not that. I mean, the top three guys, it was a great race to watch, but I wish I could have watched more of both sections of the race, because watching those two guys, Caparossi and Vermeulen, that must have been a hell of a race.
And you think about it, considering that they came together in the qualifying, they crashed together.
Right.
They started on the grid next to each other. This race started, you know, on Friday or on Saturday, actually.
Yes.
This race started on Saturday, so they've been. That must have been something just really, really wild to watch.
Oh, I'll bet. Because, I mean, their qualifying times were about 0.3 off of one another. And their race finishing times were even closer than that. About 0.3. And, I'll bet you it was good stuff to watch. But unfortunately, you know, and I
respect the director's decision of what he had to choose to show on the race, and we didn't see it. Eighth place, Randy Dupuynier on the Kawasaki. And you know, although we just finished making fun of Melandri for coming in fifth all the time, Dupuynier is, you know, he's not doing bad. He DNF'd in Qatar, but two eighth place finishes, which for the Kawasaki is better than they have been doing. You know what I'm saying?
And if the race was one lap shorter, it would have been a sixth. So, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
He got passed by both Caparossi and Primula that last lap.
Yeah, nobody's going to remember it in 2 years, but nonetheless, it's a good performance. 10th spot, Carlos Checa on one of the Hondas. Like I said, having trouble coming to grips with his size compared to the Honda, this year's Honda, just not really setting the world on fire. 11th spot, and this is probably a story that I wish we had a lot more time to talk about, but it's Colin Edwards. Third on the grid. Get off to, well, actually not the world's greatest start, but not a horrible start, and finish 11th. What's the story with that?
He's not a pleased man. If you saw him walking off the field on the cameras, he just looked pissed.
Yeah, dejected.
No, he looked pissed. Yeah. Dejected. I know dejected looks different than pissed.
He looked pissed. Some of it was down to tires, apparently.
Yeah. Or bed choice or something like that. He said.
Yeah. Colin needs to improve on that one. And it's kind of a bummer, especially after Turkey, which, you know, he crashed out of, which also was, like you said in your last show, was what is only the second non-points scoring finish the guys had in how many years with Honda or Honda?
Yeah, no, it's with Yamaha. 2005. I mean, it's amazing. Just amazing.
Yeah, not just that he finished the race, but he scored points in every race but two for the last, you know, how many? And I was like,
2 years and 4 races. So
yeah, that's great performance. Twelfth spot. Talk about somebody who might be a little disappointed and pissed and everything else. Nicky Hayden, world championship leader, 12th spot, way, way, way back. And he's 37 and a half odd seconds behind Stoner. That's a bummer.
Ninth in the championship.
He's just not getting off to a very good start. And again, you know, we're only 4 races into an 18 race season. We've tacked on another race this year. Those darn Italians getting their second Grand Prix. So, you know, a lot can happen between now and then, but
I think what's significant is that ninth actually doesn't sound as bad as his finishes, because you got to remember there are 5 guys ahead of him that have had DNFs.
Yes.
So.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, again, Nicky's showing consistency. He's finished every race. He's come in 8th, 7th, 7th, and 12th. So, you know. And the 12th, you know, you can somewhat say, well, he probably would have come in 8th if he hadn't been bumped off the track by Elias.
But 8th is not good enough for...
Exactly. Who wants to say, yeah, he probably could have come in 8th, you know? And he was followed by Guintoli on the first of the Dunlop Shod, the only of the Dunlop Shod Yamahas to finish, 13th, who finished ahead of Alex Barros in 14th spot. And like we said before, Barros got back out on the track. I'm sorry, how far back did you say it was he'd lost?
40 seconds.
The guy lost. And
I was just looking at the race, his race pace.
Uh-huh.
His race pace would have put him third if he hadn't come off. He would have been on the podium.
Wow. Yeah. The guy had a hell of a ride.
Than Hopper.
Yeah. And this is on a bike that possibly had some damage going on. Did you?
Yep.
He did have damage.
Now, I don't know. I don't know. That's a good question for Liam.
Yeah, but you motorcycles coming into contact at that kind of speed and gravel and all of that. It's not uncommon for something to be broken.
Yeah.
And then 15th spot, last of the last in the points finishers was Kenny Roberts Jr. on the KR212V, and again we're hoping that they can turn things around and start performing a little bit better. And then Nakano and Tamada apparently had a coming together Did
we saw like you know a couple laps after it happened. It happened on the third lap, and I don't think that we even saw it.
Yeah, I was going to say, it, like did they even show it at all? And it I did think they did it have a great replay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And but yeah, again, so the details of that are somewhat lost to history because of
there was a quick blurb somewhere I read that neither of the Japanese writers blamed the other. So
yes, in very polite Japanese fashion. And not finished the first lap, not finished the race, not finished in a lot of ways was Tony Elias. And, because he almost took out the world champ and didn't do too bad a job on Barros there right on the first corner. And you had some comments to make about Elias last on your last show that, the show you did a week or two ago.
Yeah. I was talking about the Turkey, incident where he, what I saw in the cameras was that he did a little bit of his signature little wiggle. He lost control of the bike, caused Rossi to slow down, caused Hayden to slow down, which caused Colin to slow down. And basically, I think it was a butterfly effect that made the OJ mistake a lot worse than it would have been. I think OJ probably would have just missed those guys and ran off the track. But
right,
you can't blame Elias for something like that. I'm not blaming him. I'm just saying that he is a Rossi said about, you know, after Turkey, he said that he's a dangerous rider, and there was a lot of talk about that, like, Rossi's just losing it, and Rossi this, and Rossi's just mad because Tony beat him. But I've been thinking a lot about this thing, and I think that what's going on is that Tony's line is just so different. He's gonna I don't know, there's nothing we can do about it, at least he should, you know, he should be careful knowing that if he's going to ride a different line than everybody else, that on the first lap, please just, you know, just stay in your spot. You can make up the spaces later when it gets a little looser. And these guys are always jumping for the front as soon as possible just to start getting, because that's much, you can't stay in rhythm when you're got, you know, a guy an inch in front of you and a guy an inch behind you.
Right.
It's extremely hard to catch your rhythm. You want to be in that free spot on the track, but, you know, unless he's collecting world champion trophies or something by knocking out Valentino Rossi last year and now Nicky Hayden, you know.
Wow.
I mean, yeah. You know, he's going to get a bad rep. I really don't know. There's only one other rider that I know of that, that has caused so much mayhem, and the other one is Capirossi in 2005 when he was when he had a really nasty rocket launch where he didn't even bother. He couldn't even turn anymore. I forget what race it was at. I'm thinking it was Estoril, where he took out like five riders it's like Edwards, Hopper, Hayden, somebody else. I think it was Kenny Roberts. I think he took out all American riders. Anyway, and then in the following race, he did the same thing to Biaggi. So it's like, you know, then he kind of got things under control, I think. But those kinds of launches, like I don't remember who said it that year, but it's like the first lap is important. It's important to get away. But if you don't get away, it's not the end of the world, and you shouldn't treat it like the race is over at the end of the lap. And I think Tony Elias is an extremely aggressive rider. When I used to watch him in the 250s, he's always been extremely exciting to watch. But when I used to watch him in the 250s, I would be like gripping the edge of my seat, just waiting for him to fly off that bike. You know, he's just doing things that motorcycles are not supposed to do, and it's extremely exciting to watch. But I think those comments that Rossi made about him being a dangerous rider, it's not that he's a bad guy, but there's going to be collisions unless he starts taking extra care.
Right, yeah. And perhaps he has a if he's gonna ride a different line, because I remember you said this on your show, and you commented that, you know, what should they have, like should they have a rule or should they somehow force him to ride differently, a different style, and I remember thinking to myself, well, no, and then you said, oh boy, what was the other thing?
Well, then I said that you know, the other riders, what are they supposed to do? Are they supposed to let him go?
Right.
You know, and of course they're not going to. It's a tricky situation. It's like I absolutely support a rider going on and trying something new and maybe changing the way these guys all end up racing. McCoy did this. McCoy started the whole spinning the wheel up and made people even realize something about the tires that nobody even expected, you know? I mean, this is the kind of thing that we're not just developing bikes, we're developing the style of riding and the kind of things that that will do to the bikes, right? So it's all good, but I don't know. It's like, who's going to give, you know?
Right, right. And I agree, you know, but I think he has, if he's going to ride a different line that's different enough that it will intersect with the guys that are riding a sort of more standard line.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I'm not saying at all that he should not do that, no, but that he may have somewhat of a responsibility to make sure that he's not going to bounce off or have somebody bounce off him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And you know, I mean, they all do to a point. And that's one thing that racers have amongst one another is a level of trust that, you know, that this other guy is not going to, you know, freak out in mid corner and just, you know, oh God. And like slam on the brakes or whatever, you know, stuff like that, you know, yeah. Because they all know, you know, they're all professionals and they're all, you know, masters of their trade. And I think that they do have that. And I mean, you're going to get that even, you know, all the way down club racing, guys doing track days and everything. If you can't rely on the person that you're near to be capable of doing, you know, a certain level of riding, then you're going to either slow down to open up a big gap or you're going to pass them or whatever. Right.
Yep.
Just because you have to have that sort of at least some level of confidence in their abilities.
Otherwise, yeah, you wouldn't have close quarter racing otherwise.
Oh yeah, no way. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's bad enough in a car where you're, you know, they're surrounded by, you know, a cage, but you know, these guys are on motorcycles, two wheels with no, you know, no roll cage and all of that. They have to be able to trust one another because, you know, they're out there to, we all know they are out there to entertain us, to put on a show. And we don't want to see, you know, guys dying and stuff like that. So, that covers China. And we, at the same time, we talked a lot about the season so far. I think we need to wrap things up because we've run a little bit longer. There's a lot of stuff that I'd like to talk to you about, Jules. So we're going to have to do this, another one of these calls.
No problem.
Definitely one. It was fun. It was a lot of fun. And there are so many things to talk about this season. So we're going to do another one, but we're going to wrap this one up now because otherwise it's just going to get too ridiculously long. And I think it's, you know, I'm pretty happy with this first show. So thanks very much, Jules, for taking the time to talk with me. And thanks very much again for taking a lot of time to babysit the show while I was gone and all of that. And I hope you had a good time with it.
A great time. And it was an honor to be there. And it is really awesome to have you back, Bob.
No, thanks. It was, you know, again, you know, thanks to you and to everybody for the, you know, the emails and the support and all of that while I was out there on deployment, not just with babysitting the show, but with also, like I said, the emails when I was there and just everything, you know, I mean, Jules was nice enough to send me a copy of the Dr. Tornado and the Kentucky Kid and all kinds of great stuff. So, overall, it made the deployment a lot easier to deal with and, it went pretty well. So, thanks a lot. Good night, Jules. I appreciate it. And we will talk to you again real soon.
Ciao, Bob.
All right. You've been listening to a conversation that Jules Cisek and I had talking about 2007 season so far. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we enjoyed talking about it. As you can tell, both of us like to talk. And Jules is just amazing, the knowledge that the guy has and insight and everything into MotoGP. Is he's got a memory like a steel trap and can just pull up interesting statistics and things like that. So I always enjoy bouncing ideas off of him and things like that. It was a good time. I enjoyed it a lot. As I said in the intro, got a track day coming up next week, so the next show might be a tiny bit delayed, but we will get it up. And I do want to say a big thank you to Komodo Gear, Wayne over at Komodo Gear. If you've never checked out the Komodo Gear website for their leathers and protective suits and jackets and all that sort of stuff, you need to check it out. It's KomodoGear.com, and I'll be wearing my Komodo Gear leathers out there on my track day. I just wanted to send out another thank you there to Wayne.
And other than that, I think we're about done for the day, and we will talk to you again next week. If you would like to send email about the show at all, the email address to send everything is motogpod@motogpod.com. Both Jules and I and Jim Race will get email address to that. If you'd like to send individual emails to all of us, you can send it to popmonkey@motogpod. That's Jules. It's popmonkey, like P-O-P monkey. @motogpod.com is for Jules, and I'm Bob@motogpod.com. So until next week, have a good week out there, and we will talk to you later. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners. MotoGPOD isn't affiliated with any of them.